On behalf of this record crowd, it's my honor to welcome Mark Shields of Gergen and Shields of the famed McNeil Air NewsHour. Mark will discuss the 1992 election, but there are no boundaries in his discussion. He was a Marine. He's a Notre Dame graduate. He's author of On the Campaign Trail, a discussion of the 1984 elections. He's cleanup hitter on the political analysis team of Gergen and Shields. The book says that both players broke into world-class competition in 1987. On Shields, scouting reports say that he hits to all fields, evidence he appears on Capital Gang. Although some of his best friends are Republican and Democrats, his forte is storytelling and truth-telling. Although his teammates, exclude Gergen, have large egos, he doesn't take himself too seriously. He may well be the player of the year in 1992. We're delighted to welcome you here.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much, Ken, for those generous words. It's a far nicer introduction than the one I received recently in Baltimore, where the master of ceremonies said simply, "Now for the latest dope from Washington, Mark Shields." I admit straightforwardly that I stole that line from Senator Alan Simpson of Wyoming, a man of occasional wit and frequent vitriol. Once when asked his church preference, Senator Simpson answered, "Red brick," which always... endeared him to me. I am lucky enough to be on the McNeil Air NewsHour every Friday night, and sometimes more often, with David Gergen, who of course was communications director for both President Reagan and prior to that a speechwriter for President Ford and President Nixon, who's a wonderful colleague. And on Saturday night on the cable news network, a show called Capital Gang with Al Hunt of the Wall Street Journal and Robert Novak, and until recently, Pat Buchanan, who's gone on to some other pursuits. I don't know exactly what they are. But Pat did get a very important endorsement I heard on the radio coming down this morning. Pat Buchanan was endorsed by the Friendly Sons of the Spanish Inquisition. And I think it'll give, I think it'll give his campaign a lift, and it was badly needed at this point. But I'm happy to be here with you, and I just offer these thoughts on the campaign of 1992, which is quite unlike any that I have lived through. Ken makes it sound my experience doesn't go back. I didn't hit up youth for Woodrow Wilson, but it's almost that far back. And I think we figured out that this is the 11th or 12th convention I'm going to in New York at Madison Square Garden in 10 days. But the difference, to understand the difference, I think it's necessary to understand my prejudice about politics. My prejudice about politics, some people call it a premise, I call it a prejudice, but my prejudice is that American politics reflect American values. They reflect our politics confound people from other democracies who come here, and they're just absolutely mystified by the fact that we fight out all these great social and semi-religious issues, whether it's church and state or abortion or prohibition. In the political sphere, we do. We always have. It's sort of we don't have a host religion. We don't have a national agreed upon consensus on all specific social and religious questions. Therefore, they've become the stuff of politics. And American politics, at its best, in my judgment, has really characterized the basic American values of a fundamental optimism and a belief in change. Those are the two, I think, that have characterized, distinguished, energized our politics at their best. From 1860 to 1930, the space of 70 years, clearly, emphatically, categorically, optimism, change, and nationalism was represented at the national and presidential level by the Republican Party. Beginning in 1860, we were little more than a collection of states. Our nationhood was purchased in that bloody crucible of the war between the states, and but for the inspired stewardship of the very first Republican president, we probably never would have made it. After that, the frontiers settled, the nations industrialized. Some 38 million people come here, literally from 100 different places, speaking 100 different languages, and are Americanized. Republicans are the party of change, optimism, and nationalism. Democrats are the party of Southern rebels, big city machines, immigrants, intellectuals, Catholics, Jews, trade unionists, other assorted oddballs. I mean, those are the Democrats, okay? In the space of 70 years, only two Democrats elected to the White House. I mean, Grover Cleveland in the 19th century and Woodrow Wilson in a striking parallel to this year in 1912, won with 41.5% of the vote in a three-way race because two Republican presidents, William Howard Taft and Teddy Roosevelt, both ran against each other. Comes the crash in 1929. The depression that follows, election of Democratic Congress in 1930, election of Franklin Roosevelt in 1932. Democrats come to represent change, optimism, and nationalism to a majority of Americans. 1932 to 1968, space of 36 years, only one Republican is elected to the White House, Dwight Eisenhower, who until 12 months before his election had belonged to neither a church nor a political party. In those intervening 52 weeks, Ike became in turn a Republican and a Presbyterian. Something that's always escaped my understanding, because if you're going to be a Republican, why not be an Episcopalian? They're better dressers. Now, one can argue when the Democrats ceased to be the party of change and optimism, but certainly by the mid-1970s, the Democrats have become defenders of the status quo and crepe hangers on the national political scene. Right now, we do not have a national majority party in the country. A little over a third of Americans say they're Democrats, a little less than a third say they're Republicans. The other third are presumably watching cable. But we do not have a majority party. And between 1960 and 1980, the optimism of the American people was sorely tested. Between 1960 and 1980, we didn't have a single two-term president. We had a series of failed, flawed, and tragically ended presidencies. We had double-digit inflation, an energy crisis. We had a war four presidents could not explain, end, or prosecute that took 58,135 American lives and hundreds of thousands of Asian lives. We had assassination, attempted assassination. We had impeachment. We even had Spiro, could I have the envelope, please, Agnew. I mean, we had a whole bunch of wrenching disappointments as a people. And each time a president let us down, our optimism would come to the fore and we'd be sure that the next guy was going to be better. After Johnson and Nixon, and those two men, totally dissimilar figures, but each with an outsized ego in its own way that affected and influenced his presidency. Remember at one point Richard Nixon wanted to put the White House guards in sort of these Gilbert and Sullivan costumes with epaulets and tri-cornered hats that looked like they'd been designed by somebody in the Meninger Clinic waiting room. The story is told of Lyndon Johnson landing an Air Force One at Andrews Air Force Base just outside of Washington, where the president boards the helicopter to return to the White House. And being greeted one day was the president by a rather nervous two-star Air Force general who snapped off a salute to the commander-in-chief and pointed out which one of the four dozen helicopters LBJ was to board that day. He said, "Your helicopter's over here, Mr. President," to which Lyndon Johnson reportedly responded, "Son, they're all my helicopters." Well, After these two, we were absolutely thrilled. We had somebody, Gerry Ford, of human dimension, no hang-ups, no ego outsized. How did we know this? Because he made his own English muffins in the White House kitchen. We were thrilled and encouraged. But even old Gerry Ford had been a politician for 25 years. So in 1976, along comes Jimmy Carter. He says, "Look, I've never been in the Congress of the United States." I said, "That's terrific." He says, "I've never even met Tip O'Neill or Howard Baker, the leaders of the Congress." "Boy, that's great. Never took the law school aptitude test." Marvelous. Nation's highest political office, he says, "Put me in, I'm not a politician." Sort of the functional equivalent of going down the Christian Science reading room to hire a neurosurgeon. So, Jimmy Carter comes to office. He's intelligent, conscientious, patriotic, thoughtful. But he succumbs to a virus that affects many of us in Washington. That is, in Washington, and I love Washington, I've lived there voluntarily for 28 years, but there is a municipal virus, and that is, in Washington, when we can't measure output, we measure input. If I can't tell you what I did yesterday, I can tell you how long I didn't do it. Say, "What'd you do yesterday, Mark? I got here at 7 in the morning. What'd you do? I didn't leave till 11 last night." I can't tell you what I didn't do, but I can tell you how long I didn't do it. And Jimmy Carter seemed to burn the midnight oil a lot. He changed his mind frequently. So in 1980, along came Ronald Reagan. He hadn't changed his mind since 1964. And that looked very appealing in 1980. The reality is, to me, it was best described, as many things are in Washington, by Senator Bob Dole. Bob Dole is the Republican leader of the Senate, former Republican national chairman, and candidate for both president and vice president of his party. Bob Dole was describing a black tie dinner in Washington, very prestigious event, seated at the head table, major hotel, former President Jimmy Carter, former President Gerald Ford, and former President Richard Nixon. Now, that's a pretty big time to admit, Jimmy Carter, Gerald Ford, and Richard Nixon. Or, as Bob Dole described them, see no evil, hear no evil, and evil. So, what is different about 1992? What is different about 1992 is this. The optimism, which has been such a hallmark, such a distinguishing and I believe energizing quality of American public life and American political life, is missing in action in 1992. The American people are not optimistic. A majority of Americans do not believe that their children's future will be as bright as theirs. That is totally uncharacteristic of American life and American perspective. America without optimism, because what optimism enables you to do is to live in the future, to believe that tomorrow will be better, to believe that these efforts that we expend today will be rewarded at a later moment. Once I cease to believe that the future will be brighter, once I cease to believe that tomorrow will be better, then there's a natural, I believe, inward turning, or almost inevitable, and if not natural, inward turning, that I cannot be as concerned about that. I better hang on to what I have. I better watch out for number one. I think it is an antidote to a sense of community. It worries me, that feeling that is abroad in the American voters. I've covered the primaries from New Hampshire all the way through to California, and it is not limited to one region. It's not limited to one demographic group. There's just a sense that the future is not as bright, that American education, once the envy of the world, is now the doormat of the world, we Americans have lost control of our destiny. Our economic destiny. I'm not making an argument on the philosophical, ethical, or cosmic reality of a global economy, but there is a sense among Americans that we are selling off our national treasures just to pay the rent. Whether it's the Rockefeller Center or a Major League Baseball team or movie studios or whatever, that we are no longer or less and less in control of our own destiny. We've gone from being the number one international creditor nation to the number one international debtor nation. All of these feelings sort of combine and coalesce, I think, in producing this sense of pessimism. Coupled with that is, for the first time, Americans have always had a very unhealthy or healthy or certainly skeptical attitude toward politicians. The same question's been asked over the past 30 years of American voters. Quite a few of our political leaders are crooked, agree or disagree. 1964, one quarter of Americans, that was Lyndon Johnson against Barry Goldwater before Vietnam, the Vietnam War heated up, one quarter of Americans, which had been a pretty constant figure, believe that quite a few of our political leaders are crooked. 10 years later, after the resignations of both the vice president and the president in the middle of Watergate, 1974, close to half of Americans agreed that quite a few of our political leaders are crooked. 10 years later, in 1984, Ronald Reagan running for re-election, the Olympics in this country, and a sense of optimism resurgent, that figure had fallen back to 1 out of 3 Americans believe that quite a few of our political leaders are crooked. In May of 1992, 64% of Americans believe that quite a few of our political leaders are crooked, which again is sobering. I just say that in looking at this election, why this election is different for Republicans is quite simple. The Republicans have become the majority party at the presidential level. Make no mistake about it, they've won 78% of the electoral votes in the presidential elections held since 1968. That is dominant. That is majority. But the Republicans have established that majority on the basis of what I would say three dominant values where the Republicans were seen as better than the Democrats, all of which have changed since the election of 1988. First of all, the Republicans were the party of strength. The Republicans were the party of strength, and the Democrats weren't. And this was best played out in the whole arena and theater of American-Soviet relations. Who was willing to stand up? Who was willing to be more confrontational? Who was willing to resist that Soviet threat? And it had its domestic domestic component in fights over national defense. And the Republicans said, we're for more bigger weapons, and the Democrats always seemed to be for sort of a smaller, cleaner, cheaper system that was going to be ready sometime next spring. And the Republicans said, no, we're for bigger ones, and we're for standing up to these commies and knocking their socks off or any other part of their apparel that they wanted to. And that worked fine until the collapse of the Soviet Empire. And the collapse of the Soviet Empire, now the debate in the Congress is we have a Republican president with conservative credentials saying we have to cut defense, and the argument is how fast we're going to cut defense and where is it going to be cut. And the only argument really that has emerged against cutting defense at this point is that it's a jobs bill and it's going to hurt some local economies where there are bases and forts and camps that might be closed and hurt. But there's no longer a sense of a Soviet threat, a measure of strength by a larger defense budget, by a more confrontational foreign policy and defense policy. So we're looking for a new definition of strength nationally. What is it? Is it going to be educational? Is it going to be economic? We don't know, but that's up for grabs in this campaign. But you can't sing those old songs anymore. It's kind of tough. And anti-communism was the cohesive force that really kept together that Republican coalition, which had a lot of internal inconsistencies at many points, as the Democrats' coalitions have had in the past. Second one was the Republicans were the party of traditional values. Traditional values. This had its origin in the campaign of 1968. 1968 was Hubert Humphrey against Richard Nixon. You recall the Vietnam War was at its height. Humphrey started way back, 45-29, the first Lou Harris poll. He closed fast, but he lost by an eyelash. After that defeat, the Democrats went through a period of deep soul-searching introspection. It lasted about 14 microseconds. And what the Democrats concluded was, if there'd been another week, Humphrey would have won. That was a great explanation that conveniently ignored the reality that the date of the election had been set 4 years earlier. It wasn't like somebody said on Thursday, we're going to vote next Tuesday. We always vote the first Tuesday after the first Monday in November in this country. So somebody else said, what happened? Well, I'll tell you what happened. We had this terrible convention in Chicago. Carnage, conflict, chaos, confrontation, all on television. Grant Park, police riots, all the rest of it. And Americans looked and they said, if a party can't run a convention, then my God, they can't run the country. And that seemed to make sense. The Democrats decided right then and there they would never again have another convention like Chicago. They sued for peace, did the Democrats, with all those groups inside the Washington Beltway, each with its own fax machine and its own narrow legislative policy and political interest. I'm talking about groups like the Irish Jewish Home for the Incredibly Short. Transvestite Teamsters Against the Metric System. Ex-Nuns for Global Warming. I mean, you know, each of those groups would come to the Democrats and say, we want our plank in your platform. They said, no, we can't put that plank in. Oh, yeah? You want a philanthropic? No, put it in. And put it in they did. And each time they put it in, there'd be one of these sort of semi-bizarre, exotic figures representing each of these groups walking across the television screen. And people have been Democrats all their life, who didn't go to conventions but had voted Democrat, was sitting at home watching the convention with a pepperoni pizza and a six-pack of Budweiser and saying, who are these people? At which point the Republicans came along, seized the moment and said, we are the party of traditional values. We believe in Saturday Evening Post magazine covers. We love Norman Rockwell. We're for school prayer. We're against abortion. We're against French kissing for married couples. You name it, that's where we are, said the Republicans. It looked pretty good, and it worked pretty darn well. 1989, the Supreme Court sent The Webster decision sent abortion back to the states, at which point two Republican candidates for governor, one in this state, one in New Jersey, had all but public nervous breakdowns on the issue of shilly-shallying to and froing, back and forth. Well, it's a big umbrella, it's a large tent, it's a major auditorium, they're going to put all these disparate Republican positions in. Now the Supreme Court this morning, we just were told, has come down with its decision upholding the Pennsylvania case, but for spousal notification, which is going to mean that the issue is not as easy as it's been. It will be difficult for all politicians. But this coalition, this premise and organizing principle that had worked so well for Republicans, now it takes on a two-edged sword aspect to it going into the campaign of 1982. Finally, of course, was the Republicans were the anti-tax party. The Democrats were the tax and spend party. The Republicans were the borrow and spend party. The Democrats said, you want Social Security and Medicare protected, vote for us. Republicans said, if you don't want to pay for them, vote for us. And that worked until the fall of 1990, at which point President George Bush said something about read my lips, and I said something earlier about no new taxes, but in fact, there's going to be a change in that. So we've got a whole brand new landscape in this election of 1992. Complicated in part, or made more interesting, certainly. The Democratic race came down to Bill Clinton against Jerry Brown. As I said, one candidate had his own 800 number and the other had his own 900 number. and the Republican race was revealing early in to me in terms that Pat Buchanan vote in New Hampshire, one-third of the people who voted for him were self-described Republican conservatives, one-third were self-described Republican moderates, and one-third were self-described Republican liberals, and which reflects, I think, more than anything else, it is not an ideological disenchantment. It is a sense of fury, of disappointment. I don't think rage is too strong an emotion to use to describe the voters in 1992. And that brings us to Ross Perot. And let me tell you, the Ross Perot phenomenon is real. He may go away tomorrow, but the movement that has spawned him, that has energized him, is not going to go away. It is, to me, fascinating in terms that it, for the first time, is a threat from the middle. The people in this room have lived through other third-party movements. Most recently, of course, was John Anderson in 1980, having failed to win the Republican nomination. But John Anderson had a limited constituency. He was the candidate, really, of Masterpiece Theater Democrats and Chardonnay-sipping Republicans who were addicted to wearing little pants with whales on them. I don't know what it was, but I went to an awful lot of Anderson rallies that the men had those little blue whales on there. I don't know. There's some correlation, and I'll leave it to future graduate students to divine it. But there was a ceiling on how far John Anderson could go. And certainly in 1968 with George Wallace, there was a ceiling on how far he could go. Because George Wallace in 1968 was a very important transitional figure historically that represented the Democrats who had been white Southern Democrats, who had been Democrats by tradition and inheritance, moving from the Democratic Party at the presidential level to the Republican Party, and Wallace was the place where many of them stopped in 1968. But there was a class ceiling on George Wallace. George Wallace did not remind people of Woodrow Wilson. He did not make people feel, gee, there's a president that ought to be on Mount Rushmore. He really did scratch the mosquito bites of a lot of people, emotionally and psychologically, and of northern urban Democrats, many ethnic, many Catholic, who viewed the Democratic Party being taken over by groups, I guess best described by them as elitist, who had a disparaging attitude toward the values of patriotism and religion, which those northern ethnic voters had so prized and valued in their own lives. So you had those factors. What Perot is different from is Perot comes right at you in the middle. He takes something from column A, takes a little pro-choice, takes a little industrial policy from column B, and he just kind of picks And he's not limited in that sense. And the reason, one of the reasons we've had the movements from the left and the right in the past is not only that is where the action is politically, that's where the volunteers are and have been historically, but it's also where the money is. It's where people care enough to write checks. This guy is different. He can come at you in the middle philosophically and politically. And there's a deep pockets back there that he has brought to the table himself. I think he's made a serious mistake by not spending $10, $12, or $15 million of his own money already to introduce himself to the American people, to tell the Ross Perot story, because it's an interesting story, it's an intriguing story, it's a story of remarkable achievements, but it would have prepared the voters and his supporters in particular for the onslaught that is coming, not simply from the press, but from his political opponents. George Bush has a very simple political strategy in 1992. George Bush cannot say, oh, you're better off than you were 4 years ago, because American people say no. George Bush can't say, we had a great first term, give me a great second term, and we'll finish the job, because the American people don't know what the job is that George Bush wants to finish. I mean, the doubts about Clinton and Bush are two sides of the same coin. Of Bill Clinton, there are doubts about his personal character. Just how steady, how solid. I don't know this guy well enough. Can I really trust him? About George Bush, not about his public character. Not that he's a mean man or anything of the sort, but what does he publicly believe? And in an ironic way, George Bush is paying dearly for the campaign he ran in 1988. In 1988, Ronald Reagan was leaving office as the only successful two-term president we had had since Dwight Eisenhower. And the race to succeed him within the Republican Party took on a fight over who was closest to Ronald Reagan, who was closest to him. Jack Kemp argued, I am his philosophical and ideological heir. That's what I am. I've stood with him. It was supply side. It was the basis that gave this administration its direction, its definition, and really its drama. Bob Dole argued, look, there wouldn't have been a Reagan program if I hadn't fought the fight on Capitol Hill and carried it to completion. And Paul Laxalt, the senator from Nevada, said, look, I have been Ronald Reagan's longest and staunchest supporter. When he ran in 76, I was governor of Nevada. I stood with him then. I am the closest to him personally. And George Bush said simply, look, I'm Tonto. He's the Lone Ranger. I'm Tonto. I went to all the meetings. I never said a word, never questioned anything, didn't talk to the white man, didn't talk to the red man, didn't talk to anybody. Okay, give me a chance. I've been through the chairs at the lodge. And that really, the Republican Party in that sense is more admirably hierarchical than is the Democratic. And my God, the guy had gone. He'd been recording secretary, been sergeant at arms, and it was his turn to be a president. And so what Bush ran on in 1988 was he won Ronald Reagan's third term. All right, he was the candidate of continuity. He said, I'm going to, you know, whatever he did, I'm going to continue. And Eric Severide said it best some 35 years ago, the difference between the men and the boys in politics is simple. The boys run for president to be something, and the men run for president to do something. And I think that's what the American people are going to be asking in the next 3 months. What is it you are prepared and want to do? What three things is it? Mr. Perot, Mr. Clinton, Mr. Bush. What are the three things you want to do to change this country, to make it better over the next 4 years, if you could do three? I think the Bush candidacy right now is basically predicated upon a game called King of the Hill that we used to play in grade school, and that was that whoever the biggest boy was in the sixth grade got up on a little hill and just fought anybody else off from getting up there. It's not going to be a vision about the future. It's going to be, hey, this guy, Bill Clinton, lock up your daughters. This guy, Ross Perot, he's scary, he's shaky, he's weird, he's I don't know where he's from. And you know, you hear Mussolini and all the rest of it. Mussolini has become the favorite metaphor of describing, I don't know what it is. I guess it's not as serious as calling him Hitler, but it's still fascistic, and it's more dangerous than Perón. You know, I don't know why. Maybe it'll be Franco before the fall. So that's what it is. But Clinton's job is that he has to resolve doubts about his personal character. I think the only way he can do that is by a demonstration, relentless, continuing, uninterrupted demonstration of public character. That is by being the truth-telling candidate in this campaign. by speaking to groups bluntly about what he intends to do, and oftentimes risking the wrath of the immediate audience to which he to whom he is speaking. I think he did that in the sister soldier dispute, but he just can't stop it there. I mean, if he's going to talk about teacher testing, he's got to do it to the National Education Association. If he's going to talk about limiting entitlements, he's got to do it to an AAARP convention. He's got to do it in a way that people say, my God, this guy, hey, he is different. He is telling the truth. Can he do it? Should he do it? He's got to decide. But can he do it? I don't know. But that's the campaign as I see it. Remember, I am the person who predicted that President Muskie would not seek a second term. So and finally, there's only three things the Democrats need to do in order to win in 1992. Only three. Unfortunately, I have no idea what they are. So.
I'd like to ask the first question. Yes.
One concern expressed about Ross Perot was that he could not be successful because he's not part of the system. Can an outsider coming in as president be effective?
Yes. Let me just... and this has been used against him. The criticism seems to be that it would A, be a dictator, or B, be ineffectual. The two seem a little inconsistent to me. But those are, and they oftentimes come from the same column you'll hear. This guy is a dictator, and he couldn't get anything done. Which really, is kind of, the job description of a dictator is basically someone who does get things done. So you have to understand this about Washington. Washington is a company town. It's a wonderful place. I love it. It's a beautiful place, but it's a company town, and power is the perception of power. And if Ross Perot or anybody else comes to Washington, having vanquished both major political parties, he's beaten them, all right? And presumably, he is at that point or throughout the campaign that's enabled him to win, say, these are the three things I want to do. These are my three proposals. These are my three problems I want to attack. These are my three solutions, whether it's education, the deficit, whatever, health, whatever they are. That's all you got to do is just say three. I mean, and people come up and say, well, what are you going to do about left-handed agnostics? I'm sorry, I'm not going to do anything about left-handed agnostics. You know, these are the three things I'm going to do as president. If he wins that way and he comes to Washington as president, then who, first of all, is going to be a sense of national unity? Because, my God, we all know we're embarked upon an entirely new adventure. We want our presidents to succeed. Americans always do. It's a barometer of how we're doing as a people. I mean, Democrats wanted Ronald Reagan to succeed. Republicans wanted Jimmy Carter. I mean, there's a sense when somebody wins an election, I'm not talking about fierce partisans who are just haters. I'm talking about the overwhelming majority of Americans want our presidents to succeed. So he comes to Washington having beaten both parties. Who's going to organize the opposition against him at that point? I mean, the leaders of the two parties that have just been humiliated in the national polls, one of which would probably be deprived of public financing. If they fall below 25% in a general election, you don't get public financing in the next election. We're talking about two parties that have just, I mean, we've gone from a string of Republican victories of overwhelming proportions. George Bush's was the closest, having carried 40 of the 50 states, to losing the presidency to some guy, for goodness sakes, who looks like a jockey with outsized ears and the last crew cut in America and still wearing Jack Kemp's tab collars. And, I mean, here he comes out of nowhere, and he wins. I mean, I'm telling you, there would be a sense of, awe, support. Now, 6 months he has. Every president has a window of 6 months. What they do in those 6 months, sometimes it's 3 months, but usually can be extended to six, what they do really determines in large part the fate, fortune, and future of their first term. Ronald Reagan seized it. Ronald Reagan, remember, and we were talking about this, Ken Thompson and I were before this. Ronald Reagan in 1980 was seen as somebody who was given his druthers. This is how the Democrats tried to portray him and some of his Republican opponents. If given his druthers would provide every graduating ROTC second lieutenant with his or her own nuclear device for use in a zip code outside of this one, right? I mean, that was, I mean, you know, he wanted to start World War III, obviously. His hair was prematurely orange. He'd been a Baraxo salesman. What else do you want to know about him? Jane Wyman had walked away from him. He was probably drooling. He was so old and all the rest of it. And he came to Washington with 32 new Republican House members clutching oh so gratefully to his coattails, with 26 with the Republican majority in the Senate for the first time in 26 years. And all of a sudden, his presidential platform became his presidential program. I mean, it was remarkable what he was able to achieve. He was able to achieve it, was Reagan, because he had run on it. And I think that's the key to Perot. And Perot, there's an implicitly, I think, fascinating message about the Perot candidacy. Perot doesn't run against government the same way that Reagan did, or the same way that Carter did, in terms of, you know, those people up there, it's Sodom and Gomorrah and all the rest of it. I'm going to make it work. I'm going to make it work. I'll go down there and I'll get them in the same room, damn it, and I'll make it work. That's a different message to people. You know, after 6 months, we might find out that he didn't work out or wasn't. But, I mean, he would certainly have as good a chance as any president. I think he'd have a better chance than with George Bush winning a second term to make things work. Because, again, power is the perception of power. If I think you have power, enough people think you have power, you got power. And with Bush, he will be reelected. His name will never again appear on another ballot. The race to succeed him will have begun actually the day after election. The Republicans starting to position themselves for 96, and Democrats have said, geez, why didn't I run in 92? Oh, my God, if I'd known that. I mean, you get a kick out of all the Democrats who want to spend more time with their families, right? I mean, there was Congressman Gephardt and Senator Rockefeller and Senator Bradley and Senator... I wonder how much time they've spent. I hope they've spent enough time with their families at this point. The rest of them are pulling their hair out saying, why didn't I run? I didn't know this was going to be available. So.
Next question.
Yeah.
Yes, Mrs. Garrett.
Are there any more
Garnett.
Hold on, huh?
My real question is, do you think that this election could go into the House of Representatives? And if so, and Clinton is the designated president, what is that going to do to the people of this country?
Do I think the election could go in the House? The most recent model we have for this kind of a fight, it was the election of governor of Connecticut in 1990, where Lowell Weicker, the outsider, had been a Republican senator and a popular figure, ran as an independent for governor, and against the Democratic and Republican nominees, succeeding a series of Democratic governors going back, I guess at that point, for almost 20 years. And what happened was, 16 years, what happened was it became a two-way race. The Democrat, Congressman Bruce Morrison, just kind of fell by the wayside. And 15 or 16% of the diehard yellow dog Democrats said, Bruce Morrison's my guy, and they stuck with him. But it became a race between John Rowland, the Republican, and Lowell Weicker, which Weicker won. I think Americans, we Americans are enormously pragmatic, all right? We are not terribly ideological. I mean, the difference between an ideologue and a pragmatist was once defined as an ideologue believes what is right works. And pragmatists, including most Americans, believe what works is right. And, you know, that's the way we approach things. And I think when it comes down to the two, and say, well, you know, if it's Perot against Bush. Well, I don't know. What am I going to do? You know, say the Democrats. I mean, you know, I've only talked to a few Democrats. I'm sticking with Billy Clinton. He's my guy and all the rest of it. I'm going to stick with my party. And I think it probably will become a two-way race. It's unlikely to me that it will remain a three-way race all the way through with each candidate, you know, somewhere between 25 and 32% of the vote. I don't know what the two, you know, which the two will be. I really don't. I mean, Perot has a very serious problem in the sense that the comfort level of Americans is never high with somebody running for the first time. Americans, in spite of our anti-politics attitude, do confer a certain validation and confirmation process upon the primaries. I mean, someone who comes through those primaries, and we know it's tough, and there's elbows and knees and gouging each other in the eyes, somebody who emerges from that and say, well, let's give that person a new look. I mean, maybe they've got something, because they've been through this adversarial and people in different parts of the country. Perot hasn't been through that. It is no accident, I don't think, Bob Teeter, who is the president's campaign manager and his longtime pollster and advisor and a very able fellow, has worked for President Ford as well, said Jimmy Carter is the only figure in the past 40 years in this country who was elected president who had not run before, who had not been introduced to the American people before. And he could make the case in Eisenhower, but Eisenhower had certainly been introduced. I mean, Americans knew him, loved him, revered him. Jack Kennedy had run for vice president in 56 at the Democratic Convention, had been seen on the national scene. Certainly Richard Nixon was, Johnson had run for vice president, was president when he ran in 64. Richard Nixon had run before in 60, had been a party leader. Ronald Reagan himself ran in 1976 for the nomination, did not get it. But came back in 80. George Bush had run in 80, was vice president. I mean, there's a comfort level which people look for, which I think it's a question now to Clinton. Can Clinton and Perot meet that comfort level? Because there's no doubt people want change. They really want change. I mean, they do not see George Bush as the agent of that change, of the kind of change that they feel is required. But what George Bush has to do is make the change represented by those two sort of a little bit, I don't want to say scary, but just, you know, not reassuring. And I mean, that's the Bush campaign. Now, if it goes to the House, I think if you were running for the House right now, okay, and we're your campaign volunteers and manager, and they come in and say, well, we just got the poll back. Perot's ahead in this district. Which he is in most districts, okay? I don't know if he is in this district, but Perot's at 35. You're running as the Democratic candidate for Congress at 35, and Clinton's at 20, and Bush is at 25. Now, it's got to go to the House. You're going to get asked about this. We've got to go to the damn League of Women Voters debate. You know they're going to ask about that because they're only interested in good government and high ethical matters, so they're going to ask you this. I mean, this isn't like we're talking to the Boilermakers Union. This was, you know, this is, they're going to ask you, what are you going to do? Now, what are we going to say? Now, you know, I think what we're going to say is, you know, I'm going to advise you to say is, I will abide, you know, by the judgment of the people of my state. The person who finishes first, I will cast my vote for in the House of Representatives. Yes, I am a Democrat. Yes, I believe in Bill Clinton. I hope the people of this state below in this district support Bill Clinton. But, I mean, what you don't need least of all is all the Bush and all the Perot people saying, well, I'm not going to send her to Congress. I mean, and that's another indication to me of how fragmented this political year has become. Think about this. You're elected to the Congress. Next January, you're going to take the oath of office. There is no member of Congress elected in 1992 who has not run ahead of the head of his ticket for president. I mean, there's no way that George Bush, in my judgment, or Bill Clinton is going to get 51% of the vote. So everybody there is an independent operator. There's no relationship that you have as a member of the Republican candidate for the House or Democratic candidate for the House where you feel a sense of indebtedness or gratitude toward a Bill Clinton who's been elected president or a George Bush who's been elected president because you've run ahead of them. You're in a two-way race. To win, you're going to get 51%. Right? They're in a three-way race. They'll be happy to get 42. If you said to Clinton right now, how about 42%? You can go home right now with 42%. I'll do it. I'll do it because he thinks that's good enough to win, and he's probably right. Okay? But he's going to, in other words, you're going to have to persuade in your district several thousand people who voted for Perot, get all the people who voted for Clinton, all right, maybe say 25 or 30%. Then you've got to get another 20%. Out of those other people who voted for Bush and Perot, and it's a further fragmentation. I think it's going to become easier for House candidates just to say, look, I will abide by the judgment of the people. This unless you're in an absolutely solid district. I mean, if you're in a district that's 80% Republican or 80% Democrat, you say, look, I know George Bush, he's my kind of guy. He's been a great American leader. He's a strong family values. He's committed to the same kind of thing we are for this country, and that's, I'll support him in the House. That probably wouldn't hurt you in an 80% Republican district. But in a district that up in the air, where it's, you know, everybody for himself, I think you're going to get a lot of House candidates pledging to abide by the wishes and majority vote of the, or the, you know. Then you're kind of a free agent. If the person who carries your district or carries your state falls by the wayside, all right, I mean, you know, say it's Clinton or Bush or Perot, then if it does go to the House, which I think is unlikely, but if it does go to the House, then you're a free agent. I mean, then you can exercise your own judgment. Do you think it ought to be, you know, one of the two survivors? Which one of the two? Okay, sure.
Next question.
Yep.
Yes.
What do you see happening to the party system in this country?
I think that's, you know, the inevitable consequence of this election is, I feel that the two parties have got an enormous wake-up call. They've been told by the American voters that what you're doing isn't good enough. It isn't working. And I think it's going to require and force a sense of, you know, just what we are. I mean, what the problem for the Democrats has been that they are a legislative party. And you put together a legislative majority a lot differently than you run for president. I mean, when you put together a legislative majority, there is a lot of log rolling. There's a lot of sort of putting. We're going to pick up Sam's vote over here on the basis that we're promising Sam that there's going to be a dam built in his district, and we're picking up somebody else over here. And it really is not it's an unappealing prospect. The Democrats have tried to transfer this to the presidential level, and where they appear to be caressing all the erogenous zones of the body politic. You want it, you got it, seem to be the Democrats' war chant. So I think, and the Republicans have been sort of a symbolic party, a party that has been on foreign policy and national defense, both issues of which have receded enormously in importance in saliency to voters in 1992. And I would assume that if Perot were to win, he would probably be almost forced for his own political survival to put together some sort of a political operation. There has to be some veiled threat that I'm going to run somebody in your district if you're going to just be a pain in the neck to me and oppose me irrationally and irascibly, especially if I get 60% in the vote in my district, in your district. And so there's got to be some sort of a political. Does he do that by marrying one of the two parties, making one of the two parties become his, or by creating something new? I don't think there's room for three parties. And I don't know. The Democrats are in most, I think, jeopardy of going out of existence. And I say that because you cannot continue to be a national party without a president. All right? And the most Republican voting group in the country, by self-identification, are voters between the age of 21 and 29. Now, what do they have in common? They have in common that they came to their political consciousness and awareness in their first vote at the time Ronald Reagan was either running for or seeking re-election. They saw him as a successful president. The most Democratic voting group by self-identification in the population are voters between the ages of 68 and 77. Okay, what do they have in common? They came to their political consciousness and awareness when Franklin Roosevelt was fighting the Great Depression. Political party around a House majority leader or around a Senate majority leader. There has to be a president. And I think if the Democrats were to lose in 1992 and have a candidate who finished with less than 25%, then I think the chances of the Democratic Party, heading for the Smithsonian in the next few years are probably, considerably increased. Yep.
Paul David.
Mm-hmm. What are you
going to
look for the most?
What am I going to look for the most? I remember at the 72 Democratic Convention in Miami Beach when George McGovern made his acceptance speech at 3 o'clock in the morning talking to chronic insomniacs in Guam. I talked to five Democrats on the floor who had been, I mean, they had been there in the, for Humphrey, and they'd been there for Kennedy, and they'd been there for Stevenson, and all five of them told me the same thing. There's no way. There's no way. I mean, McGovern was gone. I mean, that they were going to go home and try and save a couple of state Senate seats, but it was gone. Now, if you get that kind of a feeling at a party convention, either parties, then that is, you know, that to me is symptomatic of the kind of breakup that we're hearing the questions about. I don't think the vice presidency makes a big difference in 1992 to Clinton. I think it does to Perot because it's going to be a defining. I mean, Perot has to make a choice. Who's Perot going to choose? Does he choose a Warren Rudman, the former senator from current senator from New Hampshire? Does he enlist a Jack Kemp out of the cabinet and persuade him to run with him? Does he choose someone who's strong and bright and forceful and accomplished in his or her own right? The only thing that I think Clinton could do that would really kind of make you take, wow, it would probably be Ann Richards, the governor of Texas. I mean, if he did that, you'd say, geez. Huh? I mean, he upset the traditional geographical. He went Texas, Arkansas. It puts Texas into play. I mean, Perot can't attack her and all the rest of it. But I just think, I mean, whether it's Senator Rockefeller or Senator Bradley or Senator Gore or, they're all decent fellows, and none of them's under indictment or detox. I mean, they're very good. But what we learned in 1988 is that Americans vote for president. They don't vote for vice president. I mean, on election day 1988, all the networks and all the newspapers did 100,000 interviews of voters coming out of the polls. I mean, that's an enormous sample. All right, 100,000. They asked them the same question. They asked them a lot of questions, but the same question was asked of all 100,000. If you could vote today just for vice president, Warren Benson of Texas against Dan Quayle of Indiana, for whom would you vote? The results were 63% for Benson, 27% for Quayle. All right? And it didn't have, I mean, remember the debate between Quayle and Benson in 1988? I mean, if it had been a prize fight, the ring physician would have stopped it. I mean, it was that one-sided. But, I mean, it ended up George Bush was elected president of the United States. And Michael Dukakis went back to Massachusetts. So it is, I don't look at the vice president. I want to see if Clinton can take control of the convention. I was looking for Clinton to do something semi-dramatic. It was suggested to him that he take a train from Arkansas to New York. And it did, each day along, you have rallies along the way. And it kind of shows him in touch with the country. And it keeps the story away from New York. I mean, which I think New York is as bad a choice for the Democrats as San Francisco was in '84 with Sister Boom Boom and, all the rest of it. I mean, you got to think, there's all those cameras, they've got to get stories outside the hall. And you go outside the hall in New York City and you're going to find somebody who's got a theory about left-handed Unitarians taking over the world, and then he's going to be on the camera, and they're going to be on the microphone and accusing, Democrats of all sorts of dastardly acts. I think Clinton has to make a hell of an acceptance speech, but he has to, I think, begin to resolve doubts about his personal character by displays of public character. Whether, in fact, he can do that at the convention and begin to do that in a way that people say they take that second look, because he has to get people to take a second look at him right now. The New York Times CBS poll last week was the most devastating information, news, whatever, for Clinton, the Clinton campaign. His favorable rating was 16%, and his unfavorable was 40%. And that's just, I mean, it's just devastating. I mean, as one person in his campaign said to me, he said, it's like being in seventh place, being in a third in a three-way race in baseball. And, and someone comes up and says, well, we really need, better relief pitching. Yeah, that's what we need, better relief pitching. So he said, gee, we've got to get a relief pitcher. And that's the answer today. Well, no, what we really need is somebody who can steal bases. Yeah, that's what we need, steal. And we got to work on that hit and run play. Because everybody's got an answer, sort of a panacea to get you out of third place. And it's an awful position to be in.
I think it isn't like Reagan had in 1980. Reagan had one problem in 1980, was to prove to people that he wasn't scary. Clinton has to prove to people that he's strong, that he's decisive, and that he's independent. And I think that's the challenge of the convention. If he comes out of that convention with a lift of, you know, 8-10 points, and he's all of a sudden competitive in the national polls with Bush and Perot, then it's a brand new equation. There's a new dynamic in the election.
Next question. Yes.
This is so very refreshing because somebody. Reporters can ride on Air Force One and indulge themselves in all the cuffs off the record stories. We feel that the media is giving you what it's permitted to give you, and they know a heck of a lot more. That's been happening for several decades. How do you handle that sort of discussion?
I don't pretend to any higher degree of candor or integrity. I start off by, I like most people who run for office. I admit that. Just as most sports writers like people who play baseball and cover it. I do have an admiration for people who risk that rejection, the public rejection, that most of us don't in life. If you and I are up to become general manager of the Great Lakes Coat Hanger Company, and you get the job and I don't, they don't say, well, Shields got passed over because of his performance at the company picnic in 1987 and what he did at the Christmas party in 1983. And that isn't the way. When you run for office, especially for president, everybody you've ever double dated with or babysat for or sat next to in study hall knows whether you win or lose. So I start with the premise that most of them are not ethical eunuchs or moral lepers. And that people run for office, even though I don't agree with them philosophically, for some reason beyond just wanting to increase their law firm or pad their insurance agency or whatever. There's some victims of governmental indifference or interference or some villains that they want to bring to the bar of justice. And it's up to me to find them. I guess the thing that scares me most about this election, beyond the, you know, what it could mean at the presidential level, and which I'm not as terrified about as most of my colleagues, but is that people will get elected in 1992 standing for nothing. If we're running for the House right now, say, well, what are we going to do? Well, I'll never have an account in the House bank. Well, the House bank's closed, but I can make that pledge. I'll get rid of my parking space. I'll turn it over to a homeless person, to somebody who's handicapped, or an AIDS patient. I'll never use that. I'll never use the house gym. I'll never eat in the house restaurant. You say, wow, isn't that what a noble guy put that guy Shields down there? You know, you don't know if Shields wants to abolish public education. You don't know if he wants to triple the Medicare premium. That's what scares me most about this election. I think we occasionally do spend a little time on the trivialization of politics, on who's good on television and who isn't. And I think, you know, television has been a marvelous truth instrument in politics because you can no longer say something different in Birmingham, Alabama than you said in Birmingham, Michigan. But I think it has put a greater emphasis, which many of us in the pencil press have followed too frequently, of emphasis upon sort of personality at the expense of substance, and I think that's been a problem for us.
Yeah, Henry Theobar.
Assuming that Perot would have to put together an administration, would not a Democrat or a Republican joining up in that administration find himself pretty well frozen out of the future of whatever political party out might survive?
Well, I think that's a legitimate question. I don't know how many Democrats have gone from youth to middle age and beyond waiting for the next Democratic administration in which they were going to be in the cabinet. They're all over Washington. They're in law firms. They're in think tanks. They're on faculties. And, well, Mike, next, huh? I'll be with President Mondale. I'll be with Second Carter. I'll be with McGovern. I'll be, you know, where? I think at some point it becomes do you want to serve? Are the values you share, especially for somebody in a non-electoral with non-electoral ambitions, I mean, I think it'd be tough to turn down an offer, an invitation. Yes, I mean, does it mean you probably wouldn't be Secretary of State in the Democratic presidency that's elected? Probably. But, I mean, if he wins, don't forget this, he wins a middle campaign. He's coming right up. If the analogy I use, and it's a lousy one, but I'll use it anyway, okay? Most American presidential campaigns are fought this way. The Democrats nominate somebody who has to traverse this route through the left, you know, through the left part of the Democratic Party to get nominated. Once nominated, that nominee then rushes for the middle, rushes for the 50-yard line. And rushes for the 50-yard line in terms of, look, I believe, I want to show you my discharge papers from the Army. I want to tell you that I do believe in the Pledge of Allegiance. I hum God Bless America. I got every Kate Smith record at home, let me tell you. I really love this country, okay? The Republican, having been nominated by going through the right wing, through the Cro-Magnon Society and coming all the way through, then once he's nominated, he runs for the middle to say, oh, hey, Social Security, let me tell you what I did for my grandma. You know, nothing. If I believe in it, I believe in Social Security. I believe in civil rights. Oh, boy, I rooted for Jackie Robinson, I'm telling you. Okay, now, that's been the race to see who can get to the middle. Okay, now, as you run to the middle, there's this other obstacle there. And, I mean, I don't know what he does if he's going to be elected in November. There's nothing he would have done at that point that would have made him beyond the pale, probably. I mean, because he has to be, Peter Hart, the Democratic pollster, was the pollster for NBC and the Wall Street Journal, said to me yesterday, he said, he made a prediction. It may very well be the undoing of Perot. He said, there will be one segment where Perot says, the 8, 10, 12 second segment, where Perot either explodes, does something, says something that is illogical, irrational, offensive, whatever. He says it will be played more often than the Rodney King. He said, you know, that there will be something that will happen because people don't know him, okay? And that's part of that being around before. But if he's like that way, I don't know if he comes and says, gee, you know, you've devoted your entire life to this reform of education that you believe in. Here's a guy who believes in the reform of education. Now, are you going to turn it down? No, you know, maybe somebody who says, well, I want to be highway commissioner. I'm tired of being lieutenant governor of Wyoming, and I want to be highways commissioner. You might say, well, boy, old Joe, you know, and the chance you get the Potomac fever when there's a chance to, you know, get a job with a hole button in Washington. Maybe that in that case. But I don't think he would. Whatever else Perot is, and I say this as somebody with enormous, you know, reservations, he's a motivator. I mean, he can sell people to be part of something larger. What he did in Texas on public education was truly historic. Now, I mean, some people say, geez, it was dictatorial. You know, he used his own money. I mean, he put together a reform package in Texas, which was truly, I mean, historic in its reach. I mean, it included everything from teacher testing to merit pay to massive, massive equalization of school districts. I mean, Texas had probably among the greatest disparities in the country between rich school districts and poor, intensive preschool education. I mean, then having agreed upon it and forced it through, he then hired the lobbyists and pushed it through the legislature. He's somebody who was talking to the first person he ever hired. There's a guy named Tom Marcus, whom I went to college with, and Marcus, I said, well, how would you describe the guy? He says, look, the guy, whatever else he is, he said, he's somebody who's really not interested in money. I mean, if you look at the things he's done since he's made all the money, it's a great story to tell. Now, I think he may have blown it, I really do, by not spending 10 or 12 million of that money in May to tell this story. I mean, the education story in Texas and the other things that he's done to insulate himself from the criticism that is coming. But, I don't know. It's uncharted, isn't it, the coalition government and putting together a coalition cabinet.
One or two more questions? Yes.
My political analyst, insider friends in Washington, say that President Bush will be reelected. I assume that the European...
Well, let's all go home.
Yeah. I've been been traveling 6 weeks over the country, and everybody I ever met, and I met a lot, are all voting for Perot, they told me. It's interesting.
Yeah.
I assume the European community, Japan, and CIS want to see Bush reelected. What do you think?
I don't know. I really don't know. I guess you always want, if you're dealing with someone large, strong, important in your life, you want stability and continuity rather than mercurial change and volatility. Whether it's the bank you owe money to, whether it's another country, whether it's the company you work for, there is a certain scariness. I mean, what does a governor in Arkansas, what's he going to mean? What's he going to do? I think what George Bush has demonstrated is an interest in foreign policy and foreign affairs that are far greater than that demonstrated by the American electorate in 1992. So, I mean, it's a good chance that if one of the other two is elected, his enthusiasm and interests are not going to go in that direction, at least immediately. I mean, that whether it's Clinton or Perot, either one would have defeat Bush, I think each would take it as a mandate to act domestically and to put the other matters very much in the back burner.
One or two more questions, yep. Jack Owen.
Three-way election is necessarily going to go into the House of Representatives. However, there's not very much hold on the way an electoral vote.
Right.
What do you think the chances are this year of dogfight
and the electoral
backroom deals and incentives and door-to-door calling on electors to result in the Electoral College actually electing president in December?
Boy, I mean, you want to talk about a great novel and a terrifying development. That's it. I mean, nobody knows the electors. I mean, it's strictly honorific, or it's patronage in some states. That you become your chosen elector, and you meet in this ceremony, and you cast ceremonially your electoral. Are there anybody in the room ever been an elector? No, I mean, I don't. I've met a couple of electors, and they were usually the nephew of the city council president who couldn't hold a job otherwise, or whatever. And then, hey, let's send old Frank down; he'll be an elector. And I mean, you get these people that nobody knows. They come there, and you say between the election in November and the Electoral College convening, they could have a hell of a rush week, right? And say, how would you like to be the asphalt chairman for the entire Upper Great Lakes area? But this is one of those times where I'm grateful for C-SPAN, because C-SPAN's cameras will be everywhere, their microphones will be there, and it will be tough for anybody, I think, to the faithless elector. In fact, there was one in Virginia, I recall, when voted for Harry Byrd. Instead of, was it Truman?
No, he voted for the Libertarian.
That was more recent. That was in the Reagan. That was in Reagan. But I think Harry Byrd as well. So, I mean, maybe Virginia's cornered the market on faithless electors. Maybe we ought to begin here and find out. Okay.
Yeah. I think we've learned an awful lot, and we could learn a great deal more. The best way to do that is to tune into Capital Gain or Gang or McNeil Air. We thank you very much.
Thank you all. Thanks very much.
What a character. Yes, I kept thinking. Oh, I got to remember that.